Welcome to The Waves, Slate's podcast about gender, feminism, and social constructs galore. And today you've got me, Sol Worthen, a homepage editor at Slate. Right now in the U.S., trans people are a major boogeyman. Gender identity, trans rights, non-binary people, they're all often treated as a punchline by the right and supposed proof that society is falling apart. One common transphobic argument is that trans people are deceptive or even delusional because at the end of the day, sex is this concrete, fixed, unchangeable thing, and trans people are basically trying to override that reality. So in this vision of the world, whatever it says on your birth certificate is essentially something that will define you forever, no matter what you do after you're born. I find this argument really offensive and frankly tiresome. It's not some bold new claim, it's old news. Trans activists and scholars have spent a long time and a lot of energy explaining the nuances of sex and gender and making the case that self-identity matters more than whatever your legal documents say. So I went to women's college, and when I first got there, the admissions policy was that only people whose identity documents said that they were female were eligible for admission. I was involved with student activism to get the admissions policy changed to allow trans women to attend. A big part of our argument was that the college should focus on self-identity rather than relying on birth certificates, because under the original admissions policy, trans men whose documents listed them as female could attend the school, but trans women whose documents said that they were male could not attend. It's a women's college, so that seemed pretty backwards, that some women were excluded while some men could attend. And so I think one thing that this brings up that's worth dwelling on is that sex, like gender, is also something that is constructed. It's not this quote-unquote natural thing. We know that there's way more biological diversity that can be summed up by the categories male and female. So the question is, what function does sex as a legal and social category serve? Why do we put so much emphasis on it? And what can it tell us about gender and feminism more generally? On today's episode of The Waves, we're going to unpack some of these questions with the help of Professor Paisley Kura, who recently wrote a book called Sex Is as Sex Does, Governing Transgender Identity. Stick with us, because when we come back, the first thing we're going to do is dig into the arguments about transgender identity and the law. Hey, Waves listeners, if you're loving the show and want to hear more, subscribe to our feed. New episodes come out every Thursday morning. While you're there, check out our other episodes too, like last week's about the popular culture obsession with queens.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome back to The Waves. Paisley Kura is a professor of political science and women's and gender studies at Brooklyn College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. He is the author of the new book, Sex Is as Sex Does, Governing Transgender Identity. Paisley, welcome to The Waves.
Thank you very much. I'm really glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm so excited to talk with you. I really enjoyed the book. So for those of you who haven't read it, the book focuses on how people's sex is classified on government documents like birth certificates, driver's licenses, that sort of thing. And it explores what it means when there are contradictions in how the state categorizes trans people's identities. So what does it mean, for example, if some of your documents list you as male and some list you as female? Or in my case, for example, my driver's license has the gender marker X. So your argument, Paisley, which I thought was really interesting, reframes the conversation to focus on why the contradictions exist in the first place. So it doesn't start from the premise that sex and gender are these fixed characteristics and we just need to find a better method so that everything is consistent. Instead, you argue that the whole act of categorizing people based on their gender or sex reflects what function it serves for a particular institution. So the contradictions are valuable in terms of shedding light on the role of the state in our lives. Can you tell me a bit about why you wanted to make this distinction? I feel like a lot of mainstream trans advocacy focuses on how the government should treat trans people, but your book takes a different approach.
So, you know, I've been a professor for a long time, but also doing trans advocacy since the 90s. And of course, I've always been working on with other people trying to get people to get their gender designations right on their identity documents and pass non-discrimination laws. So I'm deeply invested in the should part of things. This is what the government should do. But after a while, I was like, okay, I just want to step back from the shoulds and try to figure out like what's really happening. Because at first I was looking at, you know, what I call sex classification in the book, trying to understand these contradictions. It's like, how could I be like, how could I have an F on a birth certificate and an M on a driver's license? That makes no sense. And it doesn't really make sense in some sense, but I decided as a kind of methodological experiment, I would say, you know what? I'm going to give up telling people or thinking about what sex really is and look about like what it does for government agencies, because that might help us understand better, you know, why governments use sex to classify people and why there are contradictions. So, and I decided to use the word sex and not gender. It was a toss up, but I decided to use sex because often that's the word that's used in these statutes. So in my book, I just define sex as, you know, the result of a government decision about whether you're M or F or increasingly, you know, X is a non-binary. And then gender, I left to kind of thinking about like, you know, larger currents and historical narratives about what gender is. So I really wanted to kind of get beyond thinking about the injustice of it, which is still important and ultimately my long-term goal, to understand more deeply why we have these differences.
One thing that I thought was really interesting in the book that I thought was illuminating for part of this is the reason that the government is involved in sex classification in the first place, or the kind of the origin of it. And sex is tricky because it's one of those things that seems so natural that many people don't think about it that much when they're filling out a form or checking the box for male or female. And a lot of people think about it as just something that is, and the purpose of listing it as part of our identification is just to reflect a reality rather than something that is being constructed. So I appreciated that the book kind of dives into that and talks about the point of the government classifying people based on sex as part of this history of having a legal hierarchy of when women were denied rights and resources based on their sex. And so the kind of initial reason that we have those markings on our documents is because of that. And so even though we're in an era now where sex discrimination doesn't kind of structure our laws to the same extent, the government is still in the business of regulating people's identities. So I wanted to kind of talk through that. And that like argument I thought was really interesting in terms of decentering transphobia as the lens to understand these things and kind of zooming out to look at sex discrimination in a broader way.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Because one of the things, I mean, a lot of us, myself included, in different publications, would kind of narrate this kind of growth of a transgender rights movement. You know, we're kind of marching forward. We're transgender. We're discriminated against. Please change the laws. And I think there's certainly a lot of truth to that narrative, and it kind of resonates with other, you know, new social movements. But I wanted to kind of get to the bottom of like whether these policies were transphobic. So I started in at the 60s, and because I was working on the New York City birth certificates. And I was realizing when I started to really look into the archives and the documents and how these bureaucrats justified their decisions like not to change the sex classification of transsexual people who came to them. You know, they wouldn't change the trans person's birth certificate in the 1960s. And I looked at the archives and I realized like it's because like sex is used to distribute rights and resources, you know, based on gender. So the reason we have sex classification in the first place is to make sure that women, for the most part, don't get as much as men in terms of rights or resources. There's always a couple of caveats to that. But whenever men are at a loss, it's because the state is saying, well, if you don't pay, then we're going to have to pay. So I realized like the exclusion of trans people from the sex classification system wasn't initially intentional. It was an accidental byproduct of misogyny and using the state's power to differentiate between men and women. And so once I understood that, I kind of argue that some of the successes of the transgender rights movement are a result of the successes of what, you know, many people call second wave feminism, though I think we're not supposed to do such generational categorizations these days. But just that kind of liberal feminism of getting the state or the business of discriminating against women. And as those barriers dropped, then the barriers for trans people being reclassified sometimes dropped.
Yeah, and I think that that is so interesting in terms of the way that these movements are actually very much intertwined. And, you know, today I think it really rubs me the wrong way that there is in some ways a pitting of feminism and trans rights against each other or seen as in opposition. And, you know, I went to a women's college. There was certainly friction there about whether trans students belonged. And, you know, that's maybe a more minor example. But then in more dangerous ways, you see like so-called gender critical feminists or TERFs who think that trans people are kind of ruining things for women. And this idea that trans women in particular are stronger or more athletic than women, cis women athletes, and that sort of thing. And there's so much to unpack there. But I think that what really kills me and what I thought was very interesting about your argument is that these so-called gender critical feminists, I feel like, are going against what to me is a key tenet of feminism, which is that biology is not necessarily destiny and that people's abilities and interests are not or should not be limited to how they were designated at birth. And these women seem to be arguing that womanhood is actually, it is about, you know, your biological sex. And that to me, it just feels like such a weird inversion of where things originally started.
Yeah, it is a weird inversion. And unfortunately, it totally resonates with right-wing gender discourse about natural differences between men and women. So sometimes I can't get my head around the gender critical thing, because even as they don't like trans people, especially trans women, they end up exactly in the pocket of the right wing, and sometimes literally are testifying against LGBT equality bills right beside right wing lobbyists. So it's very confusing to me. I mean, their purported explanation or rationale is like, we have to make sure women are safe. And like, no one could disagree with that. But when you think about the safety of women and trying to, you know, curtail sexual harassment and end sexual assault, the logical target is not to go to trans women. There's a different logical target out there. We could name them men, you know. But in a way, sometimes I think it's like men still have so much social power. Like it's too scary to pick on them. So we have to act like, you know, trans women are sexual predators, which, you know, they are not. J.K. Rowling is one of the biggest gender critical feminists out there. And it was so interesting to me that after the Dobbs decision came down, and she's always commenting on U.S. politics, after the Dobbs decision came down, she had nothing to say. She didn't seem to care. It took her like a week to say something, and she wrapped it up in a transphobic tweet. It's just like their priorities are really skewed.
And so much of it, you know, seems like you would think that is something that, you know, someone who considers himself a feminist or calls himself a feminist would care about. But, you know, I feel like abortion is a good example in terms of something that, even though it's a woman's issue, you know, it's also about bodily autonomy. And that is something that is so important to trans activism, and this idea that you are the person who is in control of your body and your identity. And I think that abortion activism and trans activism can really align in that rubric. But then you get people who really are saying, well, actually, biological sex is real, and that's why we're against trans people. And they are actually not as invested in something like bodily autonomy as they might claim to be. And you see that in examples like the J.K. Rowling silence.
Yeah, and it's hard to know if they're against trans people having bodily autonomy, how they can argue that pregnant women should have bodily autonomy. Like, because it just seems a very mixed up argument.
We're going to take a break here, but if you want to hear more from Paisley and myself on another topic, check out our Waves Plus segment, where we're going to talk more about the moral panic around trans kids and how it became such a big part of the culture wars. And please consider supporting the show by joining Slate Plus. Members get benefits like zero ads on any Slate podcast, no hitting the paywall on the Slate site, and bonus content of shows like Amicus, Slow Burn, The Gab Fest, and this one. To learn more, go to slate.com/thewavesplus.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com. From the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking try free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
Do you ever feel like there's nothing new in the news? You know, there are urgent things happening in the world around you, but all you hear is noise. That's why we made What Next. Our goal is to tell you the stories you haven't heard before, or maybe a different side to the story you thought you already knew all about. I'm Mary Harris, the host of What Next. And I love my job because it helps me cut through the noise of the news. And then I get to bring it to you. Together, we can figure out what next.
Pivoting a little bit, but still talking about these rights, I thought that your discussion in the book of marriage as one of the last sex-based rights until the Supreme Court ruling on same-sex marriage implemented marriage equality. I thought that was interesting in terms of thinking about the way that, yeah, the government is still involved or not involved, but then also kind of a success of this movement. But in the book, you talk about some examples before Obergefell about trans people and their access to same-sex marriage or opposite-sex marriage, as it were. Can you tell me a bit more about those examples and what you learned from the contradictions and kind of twisted logic that came up there?
I was trying to figure out, like, why in these places where you can, which, and you could change the sex classification, your driver's license, and you could change your birth certificates. Why or was this all this bad appellate case law on marriages in which there was one transgender spouse? So it's like, that's a weird contradiction. I was like, they're just not getting what sex is. And I realized, like, no, sex is like an output, not an input. And so what I kind of came to realize is that, like, identity documents serve a different function than marriage. So identity documents are about surveilling people, tracking people across a territory, making sure people have like a piece of paper. And now it's more, you know, now it's more digitized, but a piece of paper that kind of says this is who I am. So it's actually, it was always been in the interest of like the departments of motor vehicles, you know, to let people change their identity documents. And driver's license have long were like the first state institution that like let people change, and the first state institutions to drop really difficult obstacles to changing your sex designation, like surgery or even any kind of medical transition.
Yeah, I didn't, when I changed my gender marker on my driver's license, I didn't have to give them anything. I just said that I wanted it to be X, and they did it. Nothing required.
Yeah, I think there might be like 18. There's a number of jurisdictions now, maybe 18. It's hard to keep track. They change so fast where you can do that. And then there are these cases, a whole bunch of cases, where these courts would rule that for the purposes of marriage, this trans woman who was married to a cis man was actually a man and the marriage was invalid. And I was like, why? If she can change her birth certificate or driver's license, why can't she be female for the purposes of marriage? And then what I argue in the book is that marriage serves a very different state agenda. So marriage is about kind of controlling populations. There's this kind of probably too much political theory talking about how like marriage is this kind of technology to kind of tie people to the land and to kind of create populations. And it's, marriage has been a tool of nation building. People like Nancy Cott talk about that, or Peggy Pasco in terms of anti-miscegenation laws, deciding who can get married and who can't get married. And so trans people kind of walk right into the very different function that marriage plays. So there was one jurist in the European Court of Human Rights, he was looking at a trans marriage case. He's like, oh my God, if we recognize the gender of this trans person, it's going to throw centuries of property and inheritance law into confusion. We can't do that. So when I looked at the marriage cases, I saw that like they're always fighting over something. So it was maybe child custody. It was, or often property. Maybe the one of the worst cases involved a woman named Christy Lee Littleton in Texas. And her husband died in a hospital, and she was suing the hospital for medical malpractice. And the hospital's insurance company and its lawyers were like, aha, we can figure this out. We're not going to deal with this malpractice claim. We are going to say that because Christy Lee Littleton was assigned male at birth, of course, they didn't put it that way, she's actually a man, and therefore her marriage to this fellow is a same-sex marriage. And therefore, it is, you know, not valid under Texas law. This is like 1999. And the an appellate court in Texas agreed. They said, you know, a surgeon cannot change with a scalpel what God created at birth. And so the hospital didn't have to pay out. Or other cases involved like people fighting over property and inheritance rights. So when there's something at issue, when there's a tangible thing to fight over, trans people were more likely to lose. But when it comes to being tracked in terms of identity documents, the policies have always been much more easy to change.
Yeah, and that makes sense in terms of, you know, I think as you said in the book, it is in the best interest of, for example, the DMV, if you have someone who appears to be male, that's how they identify, for their document to reflect that. And it throws kind of everything into chaos if there's that discrepancy. But as the book lays out with the examples of these marriage cases, there are people, yeah, who are fighting over money or the custody of their children. And marriage as an institution is so much of how, in the United States especially, rights are apportioned, and your access to, you know, housing, wealth development, and, you know, families and all sorts of things are through marriage. And so being able to access that has a whole different kind of outlook in terms of what you're able to do as a citizen. And kind of fighting over that has, in some ways, much higher stakes than whether or not someone has the right gender marker on their driver's license, for example.
Yeah. So that's why you were saying earlier, like, I'm trying to decenter transphobia. Like, it's good that driver's licenses and DMVs are making their policies towards trans and non-binary people better. But sometimes it's not because it's not reflective of an absence of transphobia. It's because it's helpful to the state institution we're talking about that they do that policy. So that's why I kind of want to kind of look deeper into the origins of things.
Yeah, I think that understanding that the idea of transgender identity is something that as an organizing principle is relatively new. And obviously there are people who have defied gender binaries and been kind of outside of what people generally think of as male or female for a long time. But, you know, especially pre maybe mid 20th century, most people were not thinking about that in terms of transgender because that didn't yet exist as an organizing principle, I think is kind of useful in terms of just the integrity of the argument and kind of making it hold up a little bit better because it's not as if all of these things kind of suddenly sprung into place, but have been adapted. And as you say in the book, the function of the state serves different roles in different contexts. So I thought that that was really insightful for the argument.
It's funny, I was trained as a political scientist, but I spent all my time in women and gender studies and didn't really like political science and ended up writing a very political science-y book about the state. But what was interesting to me is like we think of this thing called the state like as if it's singular. But in fact, there's all these different agencies and institutions that actually do different things. And sometimes they're working at cross purposes. So we could have someone could be an M at the, you know, the New York State DMV and, you know, an F on their like, you know, Tennessee birth certificate because they're different state agencies doing different things. And I say in the book, like sex has been naturalized as we think sex is something you're born with. And a lot of people in transgender rights and gender and sexuality studies understand that sex is actually something that is like an effect of power relations and all that sort of stuff, which is great. But I think when it comes to the state, we don't have a sophisticated view. We just think the state is some nice, bumbling night watchman. And we have to just explain things right and then the state will just fix it. But the state is this kind of, the states are a series of institutions that like have just, you know, collections of norms and rules of way doing and ways of doing things. It's not necessarily hierarchical and as rational as we think.
I thought that that was a great clarifying point to make and just really helps reframe a lot of things. And kind of zooming out with the book as well, I wanted to spend some time talking about your critiques and reflections on kind of the state of the trans rights movement. You've obviously been involved in trans advocacy for a long time, and I think there are maybe some counterintuitive perspectives on the focus and the tactics that the mainstream movement is taking. Can you tell me a bit more about that and if your thinking has evolved since you started writing the book?
I have a criticism of identity politics and the transgender rights identity politics model. Of course, when someone from outside the trans and community critiques it, I'm like, no, be quiet, you know. So I'm kind of like in that internal, external thing. So, but I do talk about like this idea that like the key distinction we always focus on is between transgender and cisgender people. So, for example, I have a chapter about incarceration where I talk about how like, you know, trans rights advocates make the kind of, it's an appealing argument to say trans prisoners have it really bad. And that's definitely true. But what it does is it implicitly suggests or sometimes explicitly suggests that cisgender prisoners are doing fine, you know, and so trans prisoners for the most part are not getting the gender affirming medical care they need, but cis prisoners with cancer are getting ibuprofen. So it's like, it's just like the wrong kind of comparison to make. So in that case, I say, let's compare trans prisoners with people on the outside who are not prisoners and look at the policy differences. And then we can think a little bit more about incarceration and how it operates and what it does. So I understand the appeal of talking about transgender people and the transgender rights movement. But I think if we don't kind of break it down sometimes and look specifically at what particular institutions are doing, we're just not being political enough.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think that the book does a good job of kind of looking at this argument of like identity politics versus economic justice. And I think that focusing on incarceration was a really good choice to make this clear. Can you tell me a bit more on why you wanted to focus on incarceration specifically and what makes that as an institution such a revealing topic for this conversation?
Yeah. And so I'm not an expert on incarceration. So, and the chapter uses incarceration as a way to talk about the economy, sort of in a more kind of Ruth Wilson Gilmer sort of way. So, what I start off looking at is like the arguments that trans rights advocates say about non-discrimination laws. Like, we have to pass a non-discrimination law or else trans people will end up doing like survival things that are criminalized that end them, that put them in prison. And there might be some empirical truth to that. But it doesn't critique prison. It suggests that prison is what happens when you do bad things. So what I want to do is kind of like look at why we have this, carceral economy, which imprison. You know, I know the rates of imprisonment have gone down slightly, but we're still like way higher than any other by many times other countries. So I want to look at like how identity politics kind of that transversion glosses over economic injustices that. And not just focus on like the non-discrimination law, because, you know, it's fine to have a non-discrimination law and have people to be able to get a job, but not if it's at the minimum wage, right? We have a minimum wage economy where you can't live on the minimum wage. So I just trying to make us broaden our perspectives a little.
So often I feel like the conversation is about, you know, pronouns and bathroom bills and whether or not, you know, trans girls can play sports with other girls. And these things are all important. But again, kind of that piecemeal approach misses a lot in terms of thinking about, as you say in the book, you know, what would be the most kind of beneficial to trans people are not necessarily those individual acts, but, you know, having universal healthcare would be great. You know, having the state not kind of regulate some of the things that it regulates right now in terms of the way that it makes these decisions about who gets what is so important to kind of zoom out and think a little bit bigger, dream a little bit bigger about what could be possible for trans people and what actually would help the most.
Because the non-discrimination laws, they're fine. And I'm not, they should definitely pass. But like, as I think, yeah, you referred to, the three things would help the most trans people the most are like, making income inequality much less worse, prison abolition, and like a national healthcare plan. So that would make the most difference to transgender people, because we could talk about all the bad stuff happening in red states, and it's pretty terrible. But we have to remember that blue state life for trans people is also not good in terms of like the access to healthcare and income inequality and incarceration. So we have to kind of keep the big picture in mind.
And I think that that goes back also to what we were talking about earlier in terms of this kind of pitting feminism and trans activism against each other, is that, again, so many of the things that help women in general are also things that help trans people. And to zoom out even further, basically anyone who is marginalized by the state, people of color, people who are, yeah, low income, people with disabilities, there's so many linkages here that trans people are not kind of the only ones dealing with these issues or the only ones who benefit from certain things becoming the reality. And I think that that is very valuable to kind of broaden the movement and see things in a bit more universal way.
Yeah, we need to kind of not just focus on these like identity-based things. And of course, I'm not, sometimes there's fewer and fewer people like this on the left, but there used to be this kind of critique of like, oh, the identity politics of transgender people is just about recognition, about getting their a stamp on their ID document. And I'm like, yeah, you try having the wrong sex classification on your ID document when you buy a plane ticket or go to your Williamsburg bar, dude. Like, you know, like, so we can't, so that kind of critique of trans identity politics drives me crazy because they're coming from cis people with usually pretty unexamined privilege to the way they move through the world. So we definitely need to have those that kind of recognition in place, even just so people can do politics slightly safely.
This has been a fascinating conversation, and I'm so glad to have talked about it with you.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
That's our show this week. The Waves is produced by Shayna Roth. Shannon Paulus is our editorial director. Alicia Montgomery is Vice President of Audio, and Daisy Rosario is Senior Supervising Producer of Audio. We'd love to hear from you. Email us at thewaves@slate.com. The Waves will be back next week. Different hosts, different topic, same time and place.
Sick of being upsold at gyms? My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.